I think individuals need to be vigilant about what it is that they're putting into the public domain and vigilant about what it is that they're consuming.
Like there's a saying, if you're using something for free, you're the product. What does it mean to give away all of your information?
Artificial intelligence is transforming our world in ways we can't have imagined a decade ago. But what happens when these tools are weaponized? Not to solve problems, but to manipulate public opinion in ways that threaten democracy. Today, I'm joined by Vanderbilt researchers Brett Benson and Brett Goldstein, whose groundbreaking discovery uncovers just how serious this challenge is. Welcome to Quantum Potential, a podcast dedicated to curiosity and discovery. My name is Sibel Raver, and I serve as provost of Vanderbilt University. As a leader in higher education and as a social scientist, I believe that we can transform higher education for the 21st century. At my core, I'm wildly curious about other people's work, whether it's in science, the social sciences, the humanities, or the arts. This podcast gives us the opportunity to break open new ideas through discovery and creative expression. Before we dive in, let me introduce our incredible guests, and I'm so grateful to both of you for being here today. Brett Goldstein has one of the wildest resumes you'll ever hear. He helped build OpenTable into a global powerhouse, became Chicago's first ever chief data officer, led digital innovation at the Department of Defense, and now spends his time helping governments and organizations understand the power and the risks of AI. Brett Benson is one of our nation's most renowned political scientists, who uses AI to model some of the world's most complex security challenges, especially in East Asia. His work dives deep into China-Taiwan dynamics, shifting global alliances, and how technology shapes international relations. And the best part, both Bretts are professors right here at Vanderbilt, but most importantly, they bring their extraordinary expertise to the next generation of researchers and innovators. Before we dive in, could you both just take us to that moment when you first broke open this story, this case, this moment? What went through your minds?
Well, it all started with a text message. So I got a text message from a researcher friend, and it included a link, and it was a dump of documents. It was a series of PDFs, roughly 400 pages. And I started to comb through it. It was mostly in Mandarin, but included technical specs, pictures of U.S. Congress people, and I knew something wasn't right. And I did the basics research and said, there's something super interesting here, so I better call my friend Brett.
He said, there's something that I want you to take a look at. And he said, I sent you the link to this secure site where he dumped everything. So I looked at it like the following day. All in Mandarin, 399 pages. 399 pages of Mandarin is like 600 pages translated to English. And so I have some language skills in Mandarin, so I started to poke through it that evening, and I was pretty shocked at what I was reading, and also really, really skeptical. I just thought, you know, there's no way that this is what it purports to be. And then as we started to go through it a little bit more, you know, I was still very skeptical, but I was pretty blown away at what it was that Golaxy claimed to be and what they claimed to be able to do.
Incredible.
And so I was really suspicious until I read one of the particular documents that was really well put together. And at that point, and that was maybe 2 weeks later, at that point I had that surge of both excitement but also dread.
Yeah, intense. Yeah. So for those who haven't read the New York Times essay, can you give us the short version, the, you know, film trailer version of what you found and why it's so significant?
One, I give the quick tech, and then you can talk the bigger picture. So imagine a system that collects massive OSINT. So that's open source intelligence. So for example, if we're talking about you, if you have a YouTube account, Facebook, Twitter, any of those things, the system goes out and it collects everything that's on the internet.
Yeah, I just learned that Spotify can publish
your playlist, all of these things. Everything there is to know about Sibel is collected into a system with the intent of crafting message to persuade you to do something. So this is a bit of a jump from what we've seen in the past where you would create cohorts. So what is a typical cohort for Cybele? And it jumped from the cohort to the individual tailoring with intent to persuade at an enormous automated scale.
Yeah, so the documents, they're documents that are about a company in China called Golaxy. It was a leak by a disgruntled employee. Mm. And Golaxy is a company, they have a website, and on their website, they claim to be an AI-driven data analysis company that ostensibly does data collection, big data collection for companies and other clients for the purpose of gathering information on public sentiment, which is a huge marketing tool.
Right.
And so on their website, they're claiming to be the number one company in China, or they aspire to be the number one company in China that does this. Political candidates who want to determine how to craft political messages and campaign ads, this would be a real effective technology to gain a market edge and to respond to market demand. And so on their website, their website presence is about delivering this type of good and service to their clients. The documents make them out to be a bit more than that. In the documents, they claim to be founded by the Chinese Academy of Sciences, mm-hmm. which is the top national research academy in the Chinese government, run by the State Council, which is the premier decision-making body in the Chinese government. And they also claim to have links to and have state-aligned goals for the purpose of shaping ideology and shaping messaging and basically to deliver propaganda for the Chinese government. And that's the part that really shocked me. And the documents are just full of this information about how they do it, how they have done it, claim to have done it effectively in Hong Kong and Taiwan. And so using the technology that Brett Goldstein just described, they claim to have these state-aligned goals to manipulate public opinion in places like Taiwan, Hong Kong, but also now the United States.
Incredible. And so that was the images, that was the lead that you had, that they were pursuing U.S. congressional leaders or other key opinion leaders in the United States, that this was not simply historic data on something that might have happened 2 or 3 years ago in Taiwan or in Hong Kong, but actually could potentially happen in the future here.
So it gave a lot of history, but then it gave a look ahead. So looking at the West and looking at the role this could play and looking at the Congress people. But then when you looked at their website, we started to get a glimpse of what they were doing. So we had years and years of history of more traditional AI neural networks. But on the website, they talked about integration with DeepSeek. Mm. And obviously, DeepSeek has had a lot of news. And we saw their move into Gen AI, which gave a lot of signal for intent. But there's one little, it's a little technical, but there's a nuance we found in the docs where it talked about protecting personas. So they would create accounts, you know, just imaginary synthetic account at John Doe, say. And they talked about how to protect it so it wouldn't be burned down by Twitter or Facebook or whomever. And they talk about it at length, where it's, let's make sure it's hidden and protected and seems real. It is atypical to see in a business intelligence context a company saying, we're going to make personas that we're going to protect from being turned off.
Incredible.
And it was that intent in there that told you there's more to the story.
And so this sense that this was not, obviously it would have been big news if it had been a more, you know, mass produced chatbot that might be focusing on misinformation or persuasion, but this idea that these specific personas would be crafted for specific individuals, whether in China or in the U.S., that would be basically undetectable or could evade standard security protocols.
Well, you're exactly right, because when you say chatbot, you know it's a chatbot.
Right.
But there's an intent here to create a persona where I don't know I'm interacting with an AI. So because of that, you enter this murkiness of what is real and what is not real. And that's both show's intent and what's coming.
So incredible, Brett. And you've said, actually, the other Brett, Brett Benson, you said this discovery proves the limits on propaganda no longer exist, right? Yeah. This idea that we can't detect what's propaganda and what's fact or what's true. So can you say a little bit more about this idea that propaganda no longer exists?
Yeah. So I don't have Brett Goldstein's technical background. So our conversations together have been really helpful to help me put this into context. In my research, I have looked at propaganda in China, you know, going back to the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And China has been engaged in sort of ground level propaganda messaging in recent years and been collecting a lot of data on citizens. Even so, I had no idea what AI-driven propaganda could do. It just hadn't really clicked and registered in my head. And so these conversations with Brett have sort of helped me put that into perspective now.
And can I just ask, you know, when I think about that, I think about print media or I think about a message. It's very hard for me to imagine that message coming from an individual because I think of individuals as trustworthy, right? So suddenly, does that mean that if it's not happening in person, our conversations are corruptible or, you know, essentially like, you know, this is the only secure mode is the analog mode, right? What does that mean in terms of trusting information if I were to get an email from a colleague? How do I know that that email isn't a very carefully individualized form of propaganda sent as if it were that colleague?
Let me put this in context of something that I do understand, because I had to really think through what the scale and capability of this new type of AI-driven propaganda could do. So years ago, I had a project with a colleague in China, and we were studying, it stopped since because of obvious reasons, but we were studying the effectiveness of Chinese propaganda on public opinion and on beliefs and just among regular Chinese. We filled out a survey and we had collected some data. And what we knew about Chinese propaganda at that time is that it was really effective, but mostly effective among a vulnerable population. A population that even though they knew it was propaganda, they didn't have opportunity to check it against other sources of information. And so my takeaway from that project is that propaganda can be effective, but it's limited because first of all, it's pretty expensive. It's hard to deliver. And most of the recipients are pretty suspicious. Even in the 2016 election here, most people who are targeted by Russian propaganda and messaging on social media, a lot of people were pretty suspicious they could identify it. This is completely different because it's increasingly not very expensive. It's easy to deliver. And then the adaptability of the personas means that there isn't just a segmented vulnerable population. I'm vulnerable. Everybody's vulnerable. Because even if you're not vulnerable to the persona itself, the persona can infiltrate a network. And then the message can be spread by individuals in that network.
Right. And so it's to very high influence individuals as well as to a random person on the street. It's not just my power as a voter. It's my power as a leader or your power as a leader or any of us who make decisions on behalf of institutions. That's incredible.
It's gotten much easier. So my example earlier where we'd create cohorts, right? Say I'm targeting Benson, middle-aged white male, right? You create a cohort and then you hope you hit it. And hopefully he clicks a button. That's old news now. So we did an experiment a year ago where we'd pull LinkedIn profile info and create a message tailored for somebody. And it knew enough about the person using Gen AI to get them to click. Like you're talking like 70 to 80% click through. Just LinkedIn. Now, with these amazing tools we've created, you can create individual persuasive messaging for each individual, which honestly, you're going to click and you're going to engage. That's how personalized it is at this point. And it's technically easy. You don't need a big data center. Like I could pull out my laptop, bang it out now and have it done in a couple hours.
And then it adapts, right? So it adapts with the interactions in much the same way that TikTok adapts. To the extent that users are engaging with the persona, it's adapt. I mean, like ChatGPT, you can interact with it directly.
I mean, that's just so fascinating, right? Because I think we like that portion of the adaptability or the adaptation, the capability of the machine to understand our tastes and preferences and to give us more of what we recently liked, right? Can you say a little bit about the way in which we understand this as dangerous to democracy?
Well, I think you'll get another two-part answer. So the challenge here is we have this amazing innovation, yet we don't know how to detect it. And we're in this pattern we've seen before where like Anthropic and OpenAI are doing, and a bunch of companies are doing amazing things. And every week there's a new advance in this. But right now, if I were to generate a short form AI generated target toward Benson, we don't know if it's an AI. Like it's now gotten beyond that, the detection capabilities. So what does democracy look like when you can't tell the difference between AI and human in a world which is very much shaped by social media, Twitter, all of these different pieces? Yeah.
At a time when we are no longer or going less regularly to political forums, I mean, it immediately makes me think of the value then of universities or the value of town halls or the values of those moments of civic engagement where you actually are standing in present in uncorruptible analog moments because of the way in which you at least know that the people on stage are saying the things that they're saying.
Well, you've made a really good point twice now on the analog side because, okay, we know we're having this conversation, like really high probability this is real. We do this in a digital way. It's trivial to change that. And we're charging ahead. And what are the mechanisms in place for any of us to know that we're really having a conversation? And the fact that we can't come up with a bunch of ideas of what's being done is a little scary.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to talk about the Institute of National Security and the ways in which both computer science and political science can address that. But Brett Benson, just on that point, the moments where U.S. elections or foreign elections have been thrown, can you give us a sense of the magnitude of the power of misinformation or disinformation in an election system or in a political system?
Yeah, so maybe two questions there. One is in the election system itself, but the other is in a political system that is a democracy. I have two concerns. One is the effect on elections. An overwhelming percentage of people and voters in this country and in other democratic countries get their news from social media. And I think that that's increasingly the case with younger people. And so it doesn't take, it doesn't take a lot to think through the implications of polluted and corrupted information in social media targeted to particular individuals and networks and the potential effect it can have on elections. There are attempts in the works to try to shape public opinion in advance of elections. Yeah. And one of the concerns that I have with respect to elections is not just that really effective AI-driven propaganda strategies can shape public opinion, but if a lot of such organizations get into this space and it creates chaos, I start to worry about civic disengagement because people don't know what they can trust or they just go to their corners. It's already happening in our country. And they go to their corners and they only listen to siloed information. And you don't sort of get this cross-fertilization of information that I think you need for a healthy democracy.
Yeah. Interesting intangibles that are incredibly important. Trust, morale, faith in the institutions that we believe are robust, like voting.
Yeah. But democracies are vulnerable on the national security front too, because so much of what we do in a democracy when it comes to making national security decisions depends on public opinion. And also, it depends on the validity of information that's coming into the system, which also could be manipulated for decision makers. And so I'm concerned about the effect of AI-driven propaganda on public resolve when it comes to big security challenges, when it comes to manipulating decision makers, by corrupting information, polluting information when they are making important national security decisions. I worry about deterrence. These are some of the other concerns that I have that are just separate from the concern that I have about elections.
Yeah. You've totally freaked me out. I'm now very much clear about the significance of the problem. I'd love to learn a little bit more about the solution, because I think that's what universities can really be about, right? Not just lifting up the problem, but actually really, really moving quickly towards an accelerated set of feasible solutions. Tell me a little bit about the ways in which you had this opportunity to do this work here at Vanderbilt. Can you say a little bit about how Discovery Vanderbilt funding made this possible and how you were able to move swiftly to be able to really identify this as a key issue that we should work on?
So one of the things that was amazing about this was the partnership. Like, often we operate in silos, and I should stay in my computer science bucket, and Benson should be in his poli-sci world. And I think through Discovery Vanderbilt, it encourages this radical collaboration where this happened at a speed that I don't know that we see in academia. I got a link. I made it safe. I realized we had something. I pulled in Benson. We surged and got through 399 pages of fun, got it out to the New York Times. And this all happened in a few months. And now we're briefing Congress, we're working on a longer journal piece, and then a body of research on how do we actually get at the problem. And this is a few months in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that Goldstein and I would have met had it not been for the opportunities that are provided here, because we live in two different worlds. And but the collaboration has been pretty exciting.
So I love this example of the two of you meeting in that moment and then figuring out how to work together. Was there any skepticism? Like, wait, you don't get my world?
No, it just kind of, it worked both technically and from the poli-sci way. The fact that I came from the ops side and Benson came from the academic side, and I was able to bring some of my sort of national security operational knowledge and Benson giving context. Like, it brought all the pieces together. And it also, what's really nice is it's really grounded. Like, the work we're doing, it matters. It matters to Congress. It matters to the NatSec community. It matters. Like, honestly, we're at the front of something that is going to be a wicked problem coming to the national security community. This partnership brought together the pieces to allow us to operate at a different speed.
Especially on this particular project, there's a role for public actors in the public space, in government, to develop solutions. There's certainly a role for people in the private sector, in social media platforms. But the individuals that have an opportunity to work on this who have the most credibility are researchers. Because we're not tied to a commercial agenda. We don't have a political dog in the fight. We're just trying to solve the problem.
Yeah. So establishing that you're the real deal and establishing that you are politically neutral, you're neutral in terms of products and commercialization, you're neutral in terms of any special interest. Tell me a little bit about what it was like as you thought about giving congressional testimony and the direction and guidance that you could provide, you know, national public figures.
So it was... We were surprised at how many congressional requests we got. And it was from multiple committees, multiple jurisdictions. And it was both giving foundational education, but also a little crystal ball on what is to come.
Yeah.
And doing it reinforced the importance of the work. Because having the back and forth with these folks who are insanely busy, who have to face all these challenges. And there was a lot of like the, oh crap, like this is a big problem. And it reinforced that academia needs to play a role here, because a traditional reactive response to this problem set, that won't go well. We're always reacting to a problem and not actually getting ahead of the threat. In this case, what happens if we're flooded with one-on-one models that understand us better than we do, and we're constantly trying to figure out how to identify them? That isn't going to work we're going to be in a very complicated world where things are trying to influence us in ways that are probably not great. So academia needs to figure out, in the NatSec community, we call it left of boom, gain ahead of the big incident.
And left of boom.
Yep. That's the Monday morning fun here.
Is that a sailing metaphor where the boom's going to swing around and hit you in the head if you
So that you would attack. Be a good like, one, slightly more gentle than the kinetic.
Kaboom. Okay.
Yep. So this is one where we, if you have the AI companies moving at this amazing speed, and we don't want to stop them, but if the landscape continues to change, what is the academic innovation that helps us identify AI versus human in a sustainable way where everyone wins so that we can understand who we're talking to and who's talking to us? And I think Academia is really the one to solve that problem.
Positioned, yeah. And I'm curious about what it was like to speak with, you know, U.S. political figures or congressional leaders and have to tell them that they themselves were being targeted, whether individually or collectively, right?
So we talked to a lot of committees, and the first question that all of them had was, are we on the list?
Yeah.
They all wanted to know.
Yeah.
And we released the document so they can go check to verify that for themselves. We don't really know the extent to which people are on the list, because in the documents, it was just a snapshot to show like proof of concept.
Yeah. You could be on the list.
You could be on the list. And it was also 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the way that this technology has accelerated the pace, the list dwarfs whatever we saw in the document by now.
It's pretty reasonable at this point to think everyone's on the list.
I mean, so that within those 5 minutes in providing that insight to these congressional groups, the key that you highlighted earlier is be prepared, be ready. What else did you feel that you could say to them in terms of policy solutions? They're asking for policy solutions after they get over the shock and dread of being potentially their offices, themselves being targeted.
It's hard to know in a 30-minute conversation what intelligent questions to start to ask about crafting policy.
Yeah.
So they asked for some suggestions, but the biggest thing is that they really want to know what the next step is in having a conversation, who should be involved in that conversation, what the topic of that conversation should be. Should it be about detection? Should it be about other types of things? And so a lot of the conversations, at least my impression was, we don't really know what to do next. Maybe we circle back and have a roundtable.
Which is really precisely what the National Summit that happens here at Vanderbilt every year is really about, right? The chance to get those voices all at the table.
There's an education piece that is required here. It's a complicated topic. We will, as a teaser, be talking about this at Summit.
Great.
This year. I think it behooves us to help Congress, help whomever get smarter on it, but that does have to parlay into action. And I think there's really a three-legged stool here. Private sector has a role, government has a role, and academia has a really big role. My fear is if we don't get those pieces in place, it's going to get complicated.
And say more, Brett Goldstein, about the ways in which different teams or different interdisciplinary groups might be really leveraged there. You know, is it that I should triple the investment we're making in our new College of Connected Computing? Do we need computer scientists? Or would your colleague, Brett Benson, be lobbying for a lot more funding for political scientists? Or do we need people in completely different areas, like, you know, folks in the arts or folks in the humanities or psychology who understand the power of the message and communication? Where do we source the talent to come up with a solution?
I think she directed that too, because she already knows what I'm going to say.
Yeah. I'm sure Benson needs lots of help. So I think it's, like, right now we're interdisciplinary. I think we need to be more interdisciplinary. And so Benson and I are working on a project now where we work on two parts. That's three parts. One is creating short form AI messages, the very best we can come up with as a sample. Two, detection methods, and then three, understanding networks. So if you find a node that is a potential synthetic message, then you can then trace it back and maybe learn a little more about the network. But if you're operating with, say, 200 characters, that's just not a normal computer science problem. Like, what are the right disciplines to bring in here to get at it? But that is a concise problem that eventually Gov, Congress, everyone needs us to solve, but it brings in all of those different pieces.
Yeah, so I hear you saying that detection is the first solution, right? Detection and tracing back to be able to identify the source and to shut it down or to turn the spigot down, right? So, you know, if someone's breaking into your home, there are many things you could do, but the first thing is to make sure that the locks are strong, right?
Well, I think part of it is we don't have a great sample of what is AI-created content out there. So it's detection, but we're also taking the stance that we need to create the best because there's a sampling issue because who knows what's out there.
Yeah.
So it's this weird role of creating this potential content, detecting it, but then where it gets even harder is what happens when your creation methods change every week. Imagine when you have hundreds of different models created, I can then create all of these artificially intelligent personas from there. They change every few days, and I need to be able to detect them.
Yeah, constant morphing.
Constant morphing. Yeah. And if you get behind in the wrong way.
It makes me think of the Philip K. Dick novel where he's where the protagonist is wearing the scramble suit, right? Where he can appear to be anything to anybody.
Right. And that's from a national security perspective, when you have a gap in detection, that's an enormous window of weakness. And we have to figure out how to not have that gap.
Yeah.
And no one knows how to solve this right now.
Fascinating. So it's a computer science problem for sure. And then Brett's like queued up to tell me how it's all these other disciplines.
Well, so the reason why we're working on this project together is because we're approaching it from two different angles. So Brett Goldstein wants to develop the technology to detect. What I'm interested in is being able to trace the source and then the impact. I want to know how effective these messages are. We can't determine how effective they are until we can detect them. If they're not that effective, then the problem is not so much about influence as it is about creating information chaos and then decreasing trust. And that would be the overall effect on democracy. So there are multiple different angles here when it comes to detection. From my perspective, catching one of these in the wild or a couple of them enables us to start to analyze the network. And then we can trace it back to the source, because another problem, I'm frankly very suspicious about our long-term ability to engage in systematic detection. But if we can figure out the source, then we have the, you know, we might have the ability to frustrate some of this at the, you know, at the spigot.
Yeah.
But the other thing I'm hoping that we can do is once we can detect a handful of personas, then we might be able to trace the effectiveness. And we're thinking about through ways that we might be able to do that to determine how much these types of messages, you know, the extent to which they spread, the extent to which they actually might change public opinion. And we're starting to think about ways that we can do that. But detection is just one side. There are other things that, you know, there are other policy solutions that we need to be thinking about. We need to be thinking about hardening the types of information that populate our AI models. Because if our AI models are corrupted at the source, then that's another place where information can be manipulated. Increasingly, national security decisions are reliant on AI models. And the hope, the long-term hope, was that AI was supposed to increase deterrence and peace because it gives us more information. It gives our adversaries more information. It decreases the chances that we might have conflicts through misperception. But if all of this is subject to misperception and information manipulation, then that kind of undoes the hope of...
Totally. You're going to go back to handwritten notes, right?
Yeah. So your point about analog is a real good one. Maybe one of the solutions here is that we start to think a little bit more about interpersonal interactions that we can trust and that we know. But AI is here. It's not going to stop.
And what does political science have to say about galvanizing or mobilizing public trust? You know, what are the key factors that lead to an increase rather than a decrease in trust? Certainly, you know, if I sit in the stands of a Vanderbilt football game, I feel a massive surge of pride, engagement, belonging, trust, right? But, you know, what are the key features that would be activated in addition to deterrence?
Yeah, this is a hard question. And some of my colleagues in the political science department are better equipped to answer this particular question. Already, we're suspicious of public opinion data. And if public opinion increasingly is manipulated, then we'll become more suspicious. To increase trust, I can only tell you anecdotally because it's really not my area, but we have to start to put more investment into interpersonal interactions in an era when politicians are becoming more disconnected from people and where more interactions are digital. It seems to be going in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Standing at the train stop and shaking everybody's hand, right? Yeah. There's some means by which working the crowd individual by individual at least is uncorrupted in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be fascinating to hear that as a next step in this conversation, as you have those radically collaborative engagements and discussions and roundtables. I think a lot about where you want us to go as national leaders in this conversation. And you've both called for that kind of urgent collaboration. What gives each of you hope? Brett Goldstein, what gives you hope?
Oh, that's a hard question.
I know.
Do you ever have hope?
We've just spent such a long time talking about what places dread in our hearts, but what places hope?
So I do have hope in this window. Like, AI is doing amazing things. There is a immediate recognition when we published on this that something had to be done. And I'm seeing us now move at a speed which I haven't seen before. There's speed, motivation, support, and there's a way. And getting back to one of your earlier questions, I haven't heard from any of the Congress folks, students, faculty, we need to slow AI down. No one's saying that.
Yeah.
Instead, we all need to work to a solution. And in my experience, when you have the right people at the table with the right motivation, we can get at it. And I think we're moving at speed.
Yeah.
And it's up to us.
I love the get at it attitude, right? That with, enough recognition of the challenge, we can solve anything in a very fast-paced and ingenious way.
And something I love about Vandy, where in my prior academic life, it was a little more focused on you published and it was great and we had Nobel Prizes and love it. But here there's that support for, and we're going to make a real solution.
Yeah.
And we're going to have impact. And I think at the Institute, we've found, especially when people come to Summit, they want to hear what we're working on. They want help. And I'm confident we as Vanderbilt can be that partner that gets at some of the hardest problems that are facing us.
That's great. How about for you, Brett?
What gives me hope?
Yeah, what gives you hope?
So I think that the same things that make democracies vulnerable are the same things that make democracies able to overcome these types of challenges. Mm. For now, any democratic society will be a cycle behind. Because a sort of a top-driven organization like GoLaxy that's incentivized by the Chinese Academy of Sciences, it's going to have an advantage. And there is an advantage. But time and again in democracies, when people are responding to incentives, if trust is low enough, then there is an incentive to try to solve that problem because there's a demand for credible information. Corporations want credible information. people in the marketplace want credible market signals. Congress, you know, eventually should be in a situation where it wants to protect and increase national security. Our national security institutions should, I mean, we have lots and lots of different individuals who are incentivized in the right direction, even if we're maybe a step behind right now. I think that the creativity that can spread across a democracy and across institutions, academic institutions and elsewhere, I think that's what really gives me hope, because over and over again, we have been able to address big challenges because of an open society where information can proliferate and where there are incentives to respond to these types of signals.
Yeah, I love usually, that. I love that idea. Yeah, the sort of, you know, it breeds greater creativity and more entrepreneurial, you know, diversity of solution that might actually yield a more powerful outcome. I didn't mean to speak over you, Brett, but I was just, my brain was immediately triggered to think about how constraining fear is to coming up with good solutions, right?
Yeah.
If you're afraid, you can't really think as clearly as if you are inspired, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Super exciting. If you had to say two things or one thing or three things to close, what would you tell our listeners? What would you suggest to them or recommend, or how would you advise us going forward?
Oh, you're first on that one.
I'm first on that one. So I think that public awareness is really important.
Yeah.
And my guess, that's the reason why we're doing this.
Absolutely.
And we, our message to Congress and to public officials has been the same on this front. I think individuals need to be vigilant about what it is that they're putting into the public domain, and vigilant about what it is that they're consuming. So public awareness, education is key on this.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, I vigilant works. Be suspicious. Like we're in an age where we don't really know what's real. And, you know, think about whether it's a deep fake, whether it's content. Is it real? Is it not? You need to think about as you, like there's a saying, if you're using something for free, you're the product.
Yeah.
And what does it mean to give away all of your information?
Yeah.
And think about that while you're using tools. I'd say that, but then I'd also say to other people who are listening, if you see content that's suspicious, send it to us. We are very interested in, and we're hearing from a lot of researchers now, we're interested in finding personas, things that are just suspicious.
Catching them in the wild.
Yes, we want wild samples.
I love it.
Yeah, and also if you have ideas for the research, would love, because we are at our heart very interdisciplinary and trying to figure out an angle to get at a wicked problem.
I love it. I mean, how profoundly democratic, right? To democratize the catching of the things in the wild. I love that. And it's very much crowdsourcing of science. I think it's a great way for us to end. Thank you both so much. This has been incredibly elucidating, obviously a little terrifying, but also really exciting. At Vanderbilt, we believe universities have a critical role to play, not just in advancing discovery, but in protecting the foundations of democracy. Brett and Brett, thank you so much for sharing your work with us today. And to our listeners, stay tuned. This is only the beginning. Thank you so much for being with me today, and thanks to our listeners for tuning in. We'll be back next time with another guest who is pushing the boundaries of discovery. Until then, I'm Sibel Raver, and this is Quantum Potential.